Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, antitrust and big tech. And Richard, this is something that we've heard mutterings about for a long time, but we've now reached an interesting political convergence in which some people on the right, including the Trump administration, and some people on the left, such as Elizabeth Warren, are taking very seriously this question about whether government intervention is necessary to break up big tech companies. And the firms that are in the dock right now are Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple. They're the subject of congressional hearings, and you've also got investigations coming out of the administration divided between the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission. But before we even dive headlong into the specifics, as read the tech companies, why don't we pull back and give our listeners a sense of the landscape here? Are there clear criteria for us to know when an American company is going to be legitimately subject to antitrust scrutiny?
Well, this is actually an extremely difficult question. If you go back and try to figure out what's going on in the antitrust laws, I like to divide it into two parts. The first part is the part that makes sense. It's the part where, in fact, you're going to have a merger between two firms who are competitors with one another, such that when they combine their relative might, reduces consumer opportunities, raises prices, and so forth. And this essentially is a situation where the efficiency gains are relatively modest, but on the other hand, the restrictive losses from monopolization turn out to be very, very great. Those are the cases where essentially you can do pretty good. And they break up into two calves. One of them is where you stop mergers, or stop cartelization, where you try to run these things. Generally speaking, on the cartelization side, it's a relatively easy call to stop the cooperation. The merger side, however, is much more difficult because often when you start creating these kinds of new entities, there are efficiency gains that offset the losses from the restrictions in output that might otherwise be imposed. And there's a famous article, some I guess 40 or 50 years ago, by Oliver Williamson, in which what he does is gives a nice graph which explains why it is that you get this triangle of losses and this rectangle of gains, and there's no a priori way to tell which of these two things is better. So generally in the merger markets, people have come to conclude that allowing individual lawsuits may not be an effective situation. So you tend to have government oversight by official panels. This is now beginning to change, not because of what the federal government does, but because many of the states have now decided that they can intervene in order to block these mergers. And just that is taking place, where a bunch of Democratic attorney generals have decided they're going to attack the Sprint-T-Mobile merger. And this is a very close call. I think they're wrong, because both T-Mobile and Sprint are kind of marginal third and fourth players. And if you don't basically let them merge, it may well be that both of them will peter out and become ineffective, so you only have two. If you put them in there, you may well get three strong ones instead of two strong ones and two weak ones. Hard empirical judgment, but at least that's the thing that's starting to go on there. And now, when you have a firm that's already together, which is the situation that you have with the four companies, it's even more difficult to figure out what the antitrust stuff is. Breaking up is very difficult to do. These firms have all sorts of multiple divisions and so forth. Many times, by virtue of the fact that they're being firms, there are all sorts of implicit cross-subsidies that take place from one to another. If you own them as 100% subsidiaries, you don't care about netting out the cash flows, because in the end, it all flows to the same bottom line. You try to break them up, and exactly which of the 3,472 permutations of breakup turns out to be the one that's going to be more sensible and create a situation which is a little bit better. It's extremely difficult to figure out what that kind of thing is going to do. And so almost rarely, almost never do you see a case, except for a very recently merged firm, in which somebody tries to break up a firm. And this is even worse in these cases, because what happens is another doctrine in antitrust law coming under attack now, which used to say that to the extent that you manage to acquire your a monopoly position. And by imagination, by acumen, by luck, or by skill, nobody's in a position to knock it down. Because what we want people to do is to work very hard to get monopoly positions. Why is that? Because if they manage to create this new behemoth, they're going to give huge benefits to everybody else. Better for a consumer that he has to face a monopoly than that he not have the product at all. And what you do is if you say that now you've got this monopoly and things look to be a bit dicey, high prices are an open invitation for other people to try to come in and pick away some or another part of what's going on. And that's the so-called Grinnell Doctrine. Today, most people are getting a little bit leery about it. It is generally wisdom to say that if you engage in abusive practices when you have this dominant position, we can stop those. What's the definition of an abusive practice? Turns out to be, again, a very elusive situation. So the basic background on the antitrust is, a priori, knowing nothing about these particular four companies and the very different market slots that they operate, the presumption should be against trying to do this. It's not at all clear that the breakup will create efficiencies. On the one hand, it may kill them. And it's not even clear after you run some kind of a breakup on whether you're actually going to get a competitive market.
So let's talk about some of the specific accusations that are being brought against these companies. One of the biggest complaints that you're hearing throughout this process is the effect that a company like Facebook, for example, has on conventional news outlets. And the argument here is that Facebook can sell advertising around these news stories that don't belong to it, that it didn't create. It's just linking through to the pieces that someone else is publishing. So it's denying the ad revenue to the original publisher. And one of the arguments that's being made here is that the media outlet should be able to get an exemption from antitrust laws so that they can band together and collectively negotiate with social media platforms like Facebook to get better rates. Otherwise, their argument is you get into a position where the Facebooks of the world are essentially eating their seed cord. They're monetizing content that someone else produced and thus making it harder for those companies to produce it in the future. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, first of all, the immediate reaction is one of great irony. Instead of saying that under these circumstances we want to enforce the antitrust law, what you're saying is with respect to small fringe producers in a given market, we're willing to give them an antitrust exemption so that they could unite together in order to have a counterweight against somebody else. This is an old theory. It dates back to the theory of countervailing powers, which was put forward by Kenneth Galbraith around 1948. And what you do is it's not clear that it's the right answer. What you may do, in effect, is to give more bargaining power to the small guys, but now you have bilateral monopoly and holdout problems. And if these guys can't come to an agreement, then the whole system could come to a screeching halt. The other question is it's just not at all clear why it is that somebody who has all of this content, when Facebook says we'd like to link you up, doesn't simply have the right as an owner of the particular situation saying, well, you're not allowed to transmit our particular links. People either have to get it from us or from somebody else, but they can't get it from you. This is not wildly unproblematic. And indeed, if you really think that a collective refusal to deal with Facebook is legal, then by definition, an individual refusal to deal with Facebook would be there. And then there's the empirical question. I mean, there are a lot of these outlets. My sense about this, based on no empirical evidence, this is my expertise, no empirical evidence, is that there are all sorts of small people coming up in all sorts of different ways, and that, in fact, there's a massive growth of the kinds of things that take place on the internet, and that it's the printed papers that are taking it. And so I'm not at all sure whether or not the relationship is cooperative. It may well be perfectly symbiotic. So there are many outlets which don't care about revenue, they care about influence, and all of the various kinds of blogs that publish opinion pieces and so forth. And if they manage to get Facebook to amplify their message a thousandfold by putting this thing out to everybody, that's like having a giant retweet, then you're going to be very, very happy about it. I'm actually thrilled, given that I'm in this market in a fairly regular way, when anybody wants to purloin my stuff and sort of put it out under their own situation. All that I ask for is that they don't take my name off of it. And occasionally they put it out on their site and then they link back. There's a convention that you can use, which would be quite sensible, is to say you could always put the first paragraph on, but not the whole article. And then you put a link so that people have to go back to the original site when you want to do that. So there are, I think, a bunch of ways that you can start to deal with that. But the thought that this is a kind of problem, and that would justify breaking up a company like Facebook or Apple or Google or Amazon simply boggles the mind under these circumstances. People go a little bit antitrust crazy. And remember, Donald Trump is a loose cannon on antitrust. He was very much against, I guess it was the Time Warner AT&T merger. I keep forgetting which companies are there. And he got blown out of the water, as he well should have been in that particular case. And Elizabeth Warren is every bit as bad. So what's happened is you get two populists, both of which are intellectually unmoored from, I think, the finer points of antitrust laws, pushing in the same direction. My reaction is if those two are in favor of something, I'm going to be strongly against it a priori, and it's going to take a lot to bring me around. And in this case, I haven't seen much that would do that.
The day before we're recording this, the assistant attorney general who's taking the lead on this investigation gave a speech in Israel where he laid out some of the considerations for the Justice Department. I'd just like to get your reaction to some of this. One of his arguments was that traditionally antitrust has focused a lot on harm to the consumer in terms of pricing. Mm-hmm. And that's largely inoperative here because many of these tech companies are either providing essentially free services or, in the case of an outfit like Amazon, you know, much of their utility actually comes from the fact that they're driving prices down. But he argued that a lack of competition can have other deleterious effects, independent of price. And one of the examples he gave was if you don't have a lot of rival companies in this space, you get less competition in terms of ancillary features. And he specifically singled out the privacy features. So if people are concerned about how their data is used on these sites, they may not have a good recourse given the lack of competition. Is that a persuasive argument to you in the antitrust context?
No, it seems to me that it goes exactly the opposite way. Antitrust deals with prices. It also deals with other terms and conditions. It's long been settled that if you're a cartel and you decide to leave price unregulated but stabilize certain terms, it's an open question as to whether or not this is going to be a violation of the antitrust law. But when you start to deal with privacy issues, it goes exactly in the opposite direction. If you've got a large company like Facebook and something goes wrong, everybody knows where the road is going to lead. It's going to back to them. They have huge resources by which they could try to combat this thing, and real vulnerabilities if something goes wrong. If you break Facebook up into four randomly associated companies, chances are each of them are going to have every bit weaker, rather, privacy protections than the one company would have. And remember, the value of a leak is not dependent on the size of the company that manages to leak it. It's the value of the information that's created. So my guess is if you break it up, the privacy features in some sense are going to be worse. It's also clear that the reputation that Facebook has will be necessarily weakened if it turns out you've got four companies, each with smaller bandwidth and smaller reputation, and something gets out there and you can't quite figure out which of these four companies was raided or tapped or broken into or hacked, you've got a real difficulty. And so antitrust law sometimes points to breaking things up in order to instill competition. But I think in terms of both reputation on the one hand and privacy protection on the other, the argument starts to go pretty much in the opposite direction. And then there's the final point. I mean, are people really upset about the use of their information? Well, a lot of it depends on how it's used. And so if what you do is you get information which is of the kiss and tell variety, I'm all in favor of making sure that nobody gets that. But generally speaking, nobody wants. And so what typically happens on these things is you never give the information in its raw form to your customers. What a customer says to you is, I would like to have the, you know, 1,000 hits in the following demographic. I want people between 21 and 25. They have to be women. And it turns out that they have to have incomes over $40,000 or whatever it turns out to be. You don't just give them the names. What you do is you say, I'm going to give you a run that satisfies those conditions, and I'm going to code it. And I'm going to put in a bunch of spoilers so that if it turns out that you use this list too often, it's going to come back to me and I'll know that you're cheated. And so it's very much in the interest of the party who generates that information never to give the information out to the advertisers who use it, but they have a strong private incentive to keep it private so they could resell it over and over again. And this practice has been absolutely standard in the industry for many, many years. So again, this is just the kind of case in which people are upset about something and they lash out, and antitrust law becomes the all-purpose thingamajiggy. It's not going to work. price is not the issue here. Are there conditions and tie-ins that you might worry about? Yeah, I think you could possibly say that. If you want to use Facebook, you have to allow us to sacrifice your firstborn son. You know, that's not going to be something that's happy. So there may be a tie-in or an exclusive dealing issue. Generally speaking, those are very, very difficult to make credible in this particular situation. Structural remedies turn out to be extremely difficult to put into place, blocking things. And transactional remedies, telling them you could do this kind of transaction but not that kind of transaction, are also very, very hard. The remedial stuff goes exponentially more difficult the moment you stop worrying about horizontal arrangements by way of territorial agreements or by price-fixing arrangements.
Richard, on this privacy point, one of the more unorthodox candidates in the presidential field this year is a guy by the name of Andrew Yang, who's beginning to get some buzz on the Democratic side. He's not a politician. His background is an entrepreneur. And he has this very heterodox policy platform, one of the planks of which is that we should all have property rights in our data that we generate on sites like this. In essence, right now, whatever data you throw off on these sites, the site itself owns it and can monetize it. He's saying the data should belong to you, and you can opt out of it being shared, or you can opt in and maybe get paid some for it. This may sound sort of superficially appealing to people who are looking for a market-friendly way to address these things. How do you think about it?
And this, again, strikes me as the following. This is something which nobody has ever done. Why is it that we assume that if somebody tries to do it, it will work? And the thing to remember here about data is it doesn't have to be either me or thee. You could easily have the following situation. The data sets are going to be put in the hands of these companies to be used under the circumstances that I mentioned, that is, as part of anonymous packages. I certainly own my data. That is, nobody wants to claim that by virtue of the fact that there's certain transactions about me that are known to Facebook, I can't keep them private in some other context or use them in some other context. So the correct model is one of concurrent ownership, which is what takes place all the time. And so, you know, you get lots of things like that. You know, somebody's got a photographic connection, and it's going to be used for business, for a presidential campaign. It's going to be used for commercial purposes elsewhere. There's nothing which says that you can't divide the data up so that the presidential nominee can use it for his future political campaigns, and that the photographer can then turn around and use that same information for commercial sales of portraits and things of that particular sort. So data is really hard. And when you start seeing these kinds of things, what you realize is this is a one-ply game, not an end-ply game. And by the time you actually have to work all of this stuff through, you come up with the following very simple presumption. These are very smart people running all these companies. They're very smart people who are trying to get into these particular markets. If somebody proposes that we do something as a matter of government coercion that nobody has ever thought about in the private sphere, you could be pretty confident that they're wrong. You may not know why they're wrong, but what will happen is you'll find out in the most painful way. You put the proposal into place, and all of a sudden the leaks become apparent, and now you've got a major crisis on your hand, which is made even more difficult because it's very difficult to unwind these things once you start down those roads.
So, final question that I'll put you. There is a slightly different macro argument out there, and it's been there for a while, that we err from the beginning if we think about these companies as conventional private entities, the theory being that they're really something closer to utilities. And so something like Facebook is what we call a natural monopoly. I mean, the very nature of the endeavor tends toward consolidation because a social network's only valuable to you if everyone else is on it. It has network externalities. Does that argument cut any ice with you?
Yeah, but which direction does it cut the ice in? There is a sort of a maxim which says that whenever you're dealing with a network industry, by virtue of the fact that all the consumers on any one part of this network have to be able to communicate with consumers on another part of the network, you have naturally a tendency to have a single guy, a single hub through which everyone moves. So now what you want to do is you want to break it up and you have two hubs. You are then going to have an extremely difficult question of how you run the interconnections between the two particular hubs so that people on network A can get the people who are located on network B, and which is one of the reasons why it is that you tend to think that the antitrust laws and the breakup stuff doesn't work for network industries, and that's exactly what these people are claiming. They're getting it backwards. And if you don't run the interconnection, you get the situation that you have in Mexico, which is kind of notorious. You get three or four companies, none of them interconnect, so everybody goes around carrying three different cell phones trying to remember which of their friends are on which network and which on the other, or some people go crazy enough and get three different different connections on three different networks. And that's not so smart either. And also, that might explain what's going on with respect to Sway Facebook, what's going on with respect to Twitter as a company. It certainly doesn't explain Matt and Amazon. Amazon does not have any network externalities and so forth. It may have certain economies of scale, but you know, if you want to go shopping and you don't want to use Netflix or network, whatever it is, you don't want to use Amazon, they're billions of places you can go. Just today, we saw just another illustration of the fact that, you know, Amazon is fallible. They used to be in the home delivery for food market. They just pulled out of it the other day because they just weren't able to compete with the four or five companies who have recognized brands in a given area. People going after the four big companies have a very strange view of the natural ecology of these markets. They assume that the market has four whales, and four whales will always manage to consume everything that's in front of them. But it turns out whales are kind of big animals, and if you look at the sea, they're medium-sized fish, and they're small fish, and there are other kinds of things inside the sea, which are shells or whatever it is, that are not fish at all, amphibians. That's the way in which this particular landscape works. And so if you're trying to make some kind of a global government, a judgment about all this, and you don't know about the way in which this whole market is moving, you're going to be wrong. And to make it worse, when you were regulating natural monopolies, public utilities, the technology didn't change much with respect to the delivery of electricity and gas. But when you start trying to do this with these modern industries that are really very high volume, very rapid evolving situation, any regulatory system that you're going to try to put into place is going to take at least several years to develop. And by that time, you've got two generations of new products, and your regulation is always going to be trailing behind. And so what you do, in effect, take a very different approach. You leave well enough alone as it is, and then when you get evidence of some very particular concrete distortion that somehow or other emerges and seems to be spreading, then what you do is you try to fix this. To give you a sort of a medical examination, one of the things you could do when you get a patient, say, oh, you look perfectly healthy to me, but I'm going to basically test you for everything one way or another. It takes a hell of a lot of money and nothing gets done by it. Or you could say, go to the doctor when you get a symptom. And for the most part, we tend to prefer the latter approach to the former approach. And in this particular case, nobody has made out the systematic argument that you can do better with a divided company, structural remedies, divisions, and so forth. Frank Easterbrook had this wonderful article titled, Breaking Up is Hard to Do. He meant it in the context of traditional antitrust law some 30 years ago, but it's every bit as true, even more so, when you start getting to network industries. And in fact, the four companies that you have so many different properties, it'd be a miracle if the same approach applied to all of them equally.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column. It's called The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.